Hello and welcome to the Texas Tribune Tribcast for the third week of April. I'm Reeve Hamilton, here with Editor-in-Chief Evan Smith.
Hello, buddy.
Ben Philpott of KUT and the Texas Tribune.
Mariano Rivera.
That was probably the earliest Ben Philpott's name has ever come up. I went in order of the table and not in order
of importance.
Do you understand that on my birthday to bring Mariano Rivera's blown save up is like a huge offense to me?
Yes, but I'll make up for it with the birthday gift.
All right. Well,
oh, really? Which he's going to go buy right afterwards.
Shh. He's right there.
That other voice you hear is managing editor Ross Ramsey, who has also joined us. Today, the four of us, we're going to be talking about UT and the goings-on at the system there. And we're going to be talking about Susan Combs, and we're going to talk...
The goings-on there.
Yeah. And we're going to talk about Susan Combs, and we're going to talk about redistricting and the budget and Evan's birthday.
There we go.
Sort of a grab bag of topics.
I hope
there
we're
going to
run out of time before the fifth topic. Right. I hope so.
No, well, you don't want to talk about the budget?
No, I think we should start by talking about Rick O'Donnell. Reeve, let me acknowledge publicly you have been on this story like a cheap suit. You have been on this story, and you have done a remarkable job.
You're the one that pays me, so you would know.
But you have done a very good job of reporting the story, I think, very fairly and very fully, and it's been a pretty interesting narrative arc.
Well, let's do a quick update without being too encyclopedia-ish. So basically, UT system...
Was he looking at me when he said that?
I don't know. It wasn't a word before he looked at you, and it's not a word now.
In February, the UT system hired Rick O'Donnell, who's a higher ed reformer, former director of the Colorado Department of Higher Education, to be a special advisor to the Board of Regents. This and some papers he'd written for the Texas Public Policy Foundation caused some concern. He was also hired at $200,000 a year, which seemed like a high salary at a time of budget cuts, which we'll get to later if Evan's birthday doesn't get in the way.
Yeah.
But, you know, there was a lot of outcry from alumni and legislators and students, and everyone at UT got very worried about this. They moved his position under the chancellor, and then... just yesterday, basically, his employment at the system ended.
We don't know. I think we don't know what happened. We don't know whether he left, whether he was forced out.
Well,
resigned.
No, we know that he. I mean, in his statement, he said leaving was not his choice.
Well, no one has said yet that he was fired.
Nobody said exactly what happened.
He hasn't said it. Right? They haven't said it. He said it wasn't my choice to leave at this time. The system's response when you talked to the system was no longer employed.
Right.
Not, oh, God, we wanted to keep him, but he had other things he wanted to do.
We tried to
persuade him to stay here.
Right. Of course, there was going to be a Rick O'Donnell story today, even if his employment hadn't been terminated, because this letter leaked out that he had written to one of the regents basically saying the reason everyone is freaked out about the work I'm doing over here is that I have asked for all of this data on faculty and the way money is spent at the university, and the people and the higher-ups at the university and the system are basically opposing this and orchestrating a public relations campaign against me. And the UT and the UT system had to issue a joint statement sort of denying this claim and saying, we are gathering this data, but it's in draft form, so we don't have to release it yet.
So he took on the people above him.
Right, so that would have been the story today, but then before that came out, they ended this.
You know,
I think... Go ahead. I think you got a martyr here, but I also think the seed of reform's planted. I think it's, you know, this letter lives on. You know, O'Donnell may have found, you know, Bevo in his parking place when he got to work yesterday morning, but now he's got this letter out that says, look at all this information that they haven't given me. And the direction is not, you know, Rick O'Donnell's a one-day story. The information they haven't given him is now the story.
Mm-hmm. Well, the reform issue is not a dead issue as a consequence of O'Donnell's departure. In fact, if anything, the cause of higher ed reform has been advanced by O'Donnell's departure.
Well, and it existed before O'Donnell's hiring.
Well, it did. But the point is that the people who are probably gleefully dancing on Rick O'Donnell's grave today and this week need to be very careful to remember that O'Donnell's departure does not end this train barreling down the tracks. You know, be careful what you wish for. You wanted O'Donnell out, you got O'Donnell out, but O'Donnell was also a lightning rod for controversy. O'Donnell in that position was going to always be an impediment to reform, because O'Donnell would have been viewed with suspicion by people on the outside.
Right.
And there are an awful lot of people who may be for reform but were against the way O'Donnell was hired, the salary O'Donnell was going to be paid, the process that went on behind the scenes without the buy-in of other regents, without the buy-in of significant people at the legislature or at the university system. Now that O'Donnell's gone, the impetus for reform has not disappeared. They'll simply find another way to execute on this stuff. And I actually think that, if anything, O'Donnell's departure makes it more likely that these kinds of reforms happen rather than less, because now that the lightning rod has been removed, they can proceed without having to answer questions about this $200,000 a year guy every day.
The subject's no longer Rick O'Donnell. The subject's reform. Right. And so the information that they asked for, as I understand it, fix me up here if I'm wrong, is basically the information you would need to compile one of these
red and black reports.
The famous example, which
right.
from which you, I mean, you could trace this story back to this, but basically at A&M they started compiling a report that showed the money that professors brought in by classes taught and research dollars brought in, sort of minus their salary, and then it showed if they were in the red and therefore losing the university money, or in the black and gaining the university money.
Right.
And this made everyone, you know, professors were very upset by this. They felt threatened. And the UT system, even while O'Donnell was there, said that they would never be producing a red and black report. But you could have a similar report without those colors and that sort of judgment built in.
Pink and purple.
Well, and now O'Donnell has set the stage for the public to get the information to do their own red and black report.
And the reformers who support the idea of reform, even if they didn't support O'Donnell leading the charge, can now go back to the system and the university and say, okay, if you guys aren't against reform, produce this information.
Well, and it's one of those things that's sort of an attractive nuisance. It's one of those things, even if you don't think the red and black reports, which rank professors and others at the university based on how much money they bring in, basically, even if you think that's a goofy way to do it, it's one of those things where you say, that's a goofy way to do it. Hey, let me see that report.
I'd like to see
it. Right.
Right.
And I think a lot of people are going to fall into that category.
It is public information.
I want to make another point here, which is an important one, and I think it's beginning to be said in the wake of O'Donnell's departure. And I want to clarify, at least from the Tribune's perspective, how we view this, and I want to make an observation about the situation in general. People have said O'Donnell got treated very badly by the media. Perhaps O'Donnell believes himself that he was treated badly by the media, by the Tribune, by the Houston Chronicle, which has been a lead actor in reporting the story, by the Statesman, what have you. The fact is that the Tribune made every effort along this story to talk to O'Donnell, to talk to Jeff Sandifer. I personally called over to the Texas Public Policy Foundation, asked for somebody over there who's working on higher ed to write a column for the Tribune saying, look, a lot of what we believe has been misrepresented. Let's separate reality from truth, or from the facts from the misperception. Let's give you the reality here. Here's what we actually believe. Here's the case for higher ed reform. The other side on this, the O'Donnell side, the TPPF side, the Sandifer side, I will say with respect, but I absolutely believe this, did not a very good job from a PR standpoint in getting the word out. They complained that the press was so hard on them. They complained that the press had it in for them.
They complained through sort of small blogs and
but the fact is, the press, and certainly I can't speak for other people, but I'll speak for the Tribune, we're very happy to have published, would have been happy, and still would be happy
right.
to publish the case for this stuff if somebody would make it
right.
Not speaking on the record, not returning phone calls, not being willing to make your case in the press does not make the press culpable
right.
for not telling your story. It makes you culpable.
Come out of your room, unlock the door,
come out of your
talk.
Room. So if right. you've got a story you want to tell, tell it. We'll be happy to tell it for you.
Right.
But if you don't want to play, you can't then very well accuse the press of having been unfair to somebody or having told one side of the story.
Well,
and that's going to now be, I predict, a meme coming out of the departure of O'Donnell. You used the word martyr.
Right.
O'Donnell will be martyred in right. the course of this, but I'm not sure that's right.
Well, it's not like we have ignored the reform movement. I had a story. I talked to Michael Crow, the president of Arizona State University, Gordon Gee, the president of Ohio State University, a bunch of big reformers.
John Silber, quite frankly, probably made the case for higher ed
accountability
and reform.
I could go through almost any university
right.
and cut a third, is that what he said?
Yeah.
Of administration?
Silber said that. I mean, Silber right. actually made the case for that side almost as well as they could have made it for themselves. Problem
right.
is they haven't made it at all.
Right.
Right.
And so I think one of the things you're going to hear now is that O'Donnell is a martyr. And I feel bad for Mr. O'Donnell because he certainly found himself in a terrible situation from the very beginning here.
Yeah.
Not of his making.
No. Right. The thing is that he was more or less doing the job he was hired to do.
Right.
You know?
And everyone
said that he was doing a very good job.
The problem was Gene Powell. The problem was the way that this was handled out of the Board of Regents.
Right.
And the problem was the people who supported that side of the issue who didn't really get into the – mud with everybody else to say, wait a minute, here's what we believe.
I wonder if they just stood up and said, hey, we want somebody, we're going to bring in a consultant to take a look at this red and black stuff and see if there's anything to this and have a, you know, going to report to the regents and we're going to pay them $200,000 a year and the, you know, now we're going to start hiring. I wonder if they'd just been upfront about it, how this would have gone.
Right, you mean it was sort of accountable and transparent?
Well, just out front. I mean, you know, I'm not saying that the administrations of these schools have been particularly accountable and transparent. We don't have that public information right, yet, right. For example.
But not that we haven't asked for it.
I'm just saying.
Well, privately, people on the reform, pro-reform side have said, well, what are the guys at UT afraid of?
Right.
You know, if they think that the story that they can tell about their own efforts to be efficient and accountable and all that mm-hmm. is a good story, then why are they so reflexively opposed to scrutiny?
Right.
I think it's a fair question to ask, and I think that the UT people should have to answer it.
Right. And now that O'Donnell's out of the way, that's the forefront question.
And there is where O'Donnell's departure is ultimately a help to the reform guys, not a hurt. Because right. O'Donnell no longer is the story, and they can move that story down the path.
Well, let's talk about the potential end of someone else's career, Ben. Ben has been following...
My career's over? Oh, my God.
Just while you were sitting here. How about that?
Ben has been following sort of the goings-on at the comptroller's office, and maybe he could update us on that and what it means for Susan Combs.
Well, you know, so this broke last Tuesday, I guess. The comptroller's office released an email saying, oops, we've left about 3.5 million Texans' personal data up on our server for, you know, about a year, and it was just there, and we discovered it. So now it's not there anymore, and we don't know that anything's happened, but a criminal investigation has begun, and the FBI is involved, but we don't know that anything's happened. Well, yesterday we finally kind of got the first official notice that something has happened. The Attorney General's office released a report saying that a phone scam targeting people whose information was exposed on the comptroller server is going on. So
they have evidence that...
Well, they have one phone call, right? And they said that this might be evidence that... It said it might be something else, but it might be evidence that something here is going on.
Well, you know, we have... I mean, this isn't through the Attorney General's office. The day that they announced this last week, we got a phone call. I guess it was the next day. We got a phone call at KUT from someone who said that the day after the announcement happened, they had already... For whatever reason, they already had a credit monitoring service, and they were called and said, somebody tried to open 5 credit cards in your name today. So, again, now that's anecdotal.
How many people are we talking about?
Three and a half million.
So there were 25 million Texans. There are 13 million adult Texans, right?
It's 18 million. It turns out to be
18 million adult Texans?
Turns out to be 1 in 5 adult Texans.
It's people.
Ross just
with
did that
the,
in his head.
I just did it. I did it before the podcast. But it's 1 in 5.
The people with the teacher's retirement system, the state employees' retirement system, and Texas Workforce Commission.
Well, we have several people on the staff of the Tribune. Are one, but we have others as well who right. have been state employees right. or have spouses who've been state.
I'm married
employees.
To a state employee, right?
And you know, we all are feeling the pain of these people because some of those people are our people.
Well, it's people with open records. Not all of them are state employees, and not all of them are current teachers. Some of them are state employees and teachers who have active but non-contributing accounts. So say you have left the school system or you have left the state's employ, you still have a retirement account, but you're not collecting
it. You haven't rolled it over to
right.
another
you're,
account.
You're not a retiree necessarily yet. So I have, you know, some friends around Austin, so do you guys, who are former state employees, former teachers, who are nevertheless on these lists. And then the Workforce Commission stuff has nothing to do with, you know, state or school district employment at all.
How did this happen? I know that's the $64,000 question, or probably worth a lot more than that.
Well, I guess it kind of depends on whose finger you want to follow. the comptroller's office initially Yuck. Said that it was by the pointed fingers. Comptroller's office had initially said, you know, that the information was sent to them incorrectly. And that's how it got.
Well,
put
before
up on the
before
site.
That, they asked.
Did they
for this
put? Did they put all the information sent to them incorrectly on their site? We're like, oh, this is wrong.
they asked for this. Up. They asked for this. They went to these three agencies and said, hey, we're trying to unload this unclaimed property, which the state has a bunch of unclaimed property, right? So, we're trying to unload all this unclaimed property. So why don't you send us your records with name, birth date, and social security number, so we can match them up against these unclaimed property accounts and contact the people whose property we're holding and say, hey, come get your property. So that starts like that. It's a relatively routine thing. And then your story begins.
Have they done this before?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, I got a letter. I found like a $125 check that NPR had sent me 4 years ago that for whatever reason never made it to me. So you know, they're trying to be nice.
So this is a win-lose for you, Ben.
Yeah. So I got that $125 check, and now I may have to pay $20 a month for the rest of my life to make sure I don't have
my world and welcome.
Somebody in Croatia has opened a Discover card in your name, right?
That's right.
So this happened, and it's a situation. How has it been handled, and what does it mean for the comptroller and her political ambitions?
Well, let me take a step back real quickly before we get to political ambitions. You know, I think one of the things that's interesting is that if this were a bank, people would be lining up for a class action lawsuit. But it's not a bank. It's a state agency. To be able to sue the state, you have to get I talked to one lawyer who said that you have to get permission twice from the legislature to be able to sue the state.
Well, yeah, they gave Mike Leach permission to sue the state. You think they
didn't give Mike Leach permission? We filed the bill, but he doesn't have permission yet. Right. You have to have the state's a sovereign, and in order to sue a sovereign, you have to have the permission of the sovereign. It's called a resolution to sue the state, and we haven't seen that yet.
And at the moment, I mean, outside of the criminal investigation that the Attorney General is doing with the FBI, I don't know that the Comptroller's Office is out any money of this on this yet, because they are not paying for the discounted. You can't have a discounted credit check run. It's like 70% off the regular price, but the state's not paying the 70%.
They don't
off.
Have to pay those guys. They told these guys, you know, if you'll give us a discount on this, we're going to refer 3.5 million people to you at 30%. You think you can make any money
the
on
that? The criminal
there?
Investigation, however, does not impact the how this happened in the first place part of the story. The criminal investigation is into what might have happened with the purloined data.
Well, you can't do a criminal investigation of what might have happened. This isn't the Department of Pre-Crime. You have to do a criminal investigation of a crime.
My point is that to say, well, there's progress in this story and that the Attorney General's office has opened a criminal investigation is a true fact, but ultimately it's irrelevant to the original question, which is the Comptroller's office somehow allowed this information to get out there.
Right. And at the moment, the response has been, we've fired four people.
What is the accountability? Well, they fired four people, including one poor schmuck who they made write a letter over his name, and by the time it was received by everybody, he was already out the door.
Victor Gonzalez, the chief technology officer of the CPA's office. So, yeah.
What happened to the fish rots from the head down is the question I have.
Well, Susan Combs has not made herself available to, as far as I've seen, any media in this. All the stories from last Tuesday are RJ DeSilva, one of her spokespeople, doing interviews. And then the letter from...
Hey, RJ, you see that grenade over there? Go jump on it.
Yeah.
So Combs goes to the legislature and tries to blame the agencies that sent her the information. Well, they didn't leave it on the shelf. And they all very quickly said, we sent it over according to protocol and... Forget about that. She sends out this letter. Her name's not on the letterhead. It's not on the letter. It's not anywhere. The letter's a masterpiece of equivocation. It's just a masterpiece. She's not taking responsibility. But, you know, you do get back to this thing Ben said. There's 3.5 million people. There's a criminal investigation. I assume if there's a criminal investigation that somewhere someone believes there was a crime or might be a crime. And, you possibly got all of these people coming in saying, hey, we've got all of these cases of identity theft. Who's responsible? The state may say you can sue us or you may not, but eventually it comes home to the Comptroller of Public Accounts, who wants to be the next lieutenant governor. And I think politically to get to the political question, I think that's, you know, fatal.
So you think that this has caused, in all seriousness, you think this causes her political problems that she would not be able to
scale? If she can sail past this, then...
She could sail past anything.
Right.
Suddenly, whether she was pro-choice previously or currently is no longer the biggest issue that she has.
Never say never, but I mean, this is a huge liability.
The ad sort of writes itself, right?
Yes.
Yeah. You've got all these, you don't even get to Democrats on this. There's two other Republicans who want this job,
at least.
Right.
Not counting whichever senator is. The assumption here is that the lieutenant governor runs for the Senate. Senate elects one of its own members to run the body for the next 2 years. That person perhaps runs. So she might have to not only get through Patterson and Staples in a primary, if we believe the scuttle out on the street about this, but also quote incumbent, and yet this would be a big impediment to her being able
to. She's going to, you'd have to make a heck of a glass of lemonade here. This is a lot of lemons.
And one person that I talked to yesterday, said that it might not even be up to the voters whether or not she does well in the primary, that, once funders decide where they're going to put their money.
This is Royal Massé who you talked to.
No, actually, this was Jason Stanford.
Jason Stanford, Democrat.
Democrat.
And then you also talked to Royal Massé, who's a Republican, well-respected former party official, right?
Yeah, former,
He seemed to think that it could blow over for a couple of reasons. Number one, whatever race she's running for is a couple years off.
Right.
And in a time of actual political criminal scandals, a mistake might not be something that could kill her.
The worst politics is not doing your job. And doing your job over there is keeping things secret. I mean, this is the agency that has all the tax records. This is the agency that has all the payroll records.
But I want to make an observation here. So we've reported now, not once but twice, on how the TEA has misplaced or, you know, left in their other pants or whatever else institutionally the Social Security numbers of tens of thousands of public school students.
Right.
Why is that not a scandal? I guess is it numbers that's Robert only tens
Scott's
of thousands?
Robert Scott's not an elected official, for one thing. I mean, the head of the TEA is not an elected official. This is an official who answers directly to voters.
Right.
And these are voters whose records are at peril here.
Yeah, and Jason Stanford said the campaign ad, the attack ad's pretty easy to write. Like Reeve said, it's Susan Combs made your information less safe.
Yeah, it's just bad juju.
Well, with an eye on the next election, let's talk redistricting for a bit.
Pretty graceful, I thought.
Yeah, that was nicely done, yeah.
Yeah, the one thing that sort of...
we can make even your graceful moments ungraceful.
I know.
He was
so now we're in
one
of those ungraceful moments. One thing that particularly caught my eye was yesterday the redistricting committee met while the House was in session, and they did not meet in a room that had public viewing access.
They met in a Stuckey's in Maynard.
No.
But Jessica Farrar got up and said, why is this happening? Whoever was sitting in the chair said the chair was not advised. She asked them to become advised, but I don't know if they did. But basically just tweeters and reporters had to go in there to cover it for people.
They basically said, we follow the rules. The rules don't say we can't. We can. You know, they went, and you may not know that there's an agricultural museum in the state capitol.
There is.
In fact, an agricultural museum in the state capitol, and it does not have the installed cameras that committee rooms have.
Why create suspicion? I mean, I think that's
the theme of our podcast.
I like Burt Solomons, but honestly, my question to Chairman Solomons would be, if you're not trying to do something untoward, then why give people the reason to think that you are?
How would this be different if you weren't hiding?
Right. What would be different if you did it in a room with cameras?
Yeah.
You know, this is one of the most controversial things that the legislature does every 10 years, right? It just is.
Right.
And there are a lot of unhappy people, not just Democrats, but Republicans.
Yeah, it's a where's the rest of me exercise. You know, there's a bunch of members. I don't have the numbers right in front of me, but I think there were, Evan, you saw these. There are 8 members whose districts have, or 12 members whose districts have less than 25% of their current districts.
And another new district, 8 who have less than 50, right?
Right, yeah. So a lot of these people really got displaced. Veronica Gonzalez and Aaron Pena, in order to protect Aaron Pena in what's otherwise a Democratic county, they moved the districts around so that only 1.3% of his current district is in his new district. Only 1.5% of her current district is in her new district.
So she's representing effectively a totally new district.
Minus
the homes directly around her house.
In other words, she never represented 98.5% of these people before.
Yeah. Do they not look that as an opportunity to make 98.5% of new friends?
No, Reeve. That's not how – it's not like Match.com. No, they don't actually – no.
Well, and then there's some underlying problems in this thing. You know, one of the arguments in these maps is that Latinos made up 65% of the growth in Texas and ought to be
over the last 10 years. I thought it was higher than that.
Over the last 10 years. And that ought to be reflected.
65% of the, 3 million in growth?
Yeah, 3.5 million.
3.5 million in
growth. And that the maps ought to reflect that. Solomon's first map actually went backwards one step and had one less Latino opportunity district. This is a district where there are enough Latino voters to exercise their will, whatever it is, in a district.
Choice.
So sometimes they choose an Hispanic, sometimes they don't, but the Hispanic voters have an opportunity. And his first map didn't create, in fact, went backwards one. His new map adds 2, but the Latinos say that's not enough. That doesn't reflect the numbers.
Cases in which, as in Houston is the example that people talk about, not the only example, where the people who oppose the Solomon's map say, you know, you're messing with Vaux and Hochberg.
Right.
Those are both minority opportunity districts. Hochberg's district is majority Hispanic.
Right.
Vaux's district is minority majority. You're pairing Vaux and Hochberg. That's just on its face not going to pass muster from a voting rights act standpoint.
So the quick look at this is that, you know, if you'd gone the other way with Hochberg's district, you would have paired him with Sarah Davis, who's a freshman Republican who beat Ellen Cohn in the November election. But it's a Republican map. It's a Republican House, and they're not pairing Republicans where they don't have to.
Right.
Now, to be fair, most of the pairs in this map, most of the new districts in this map where there are 2 incumbents.
almost our, all of them are Republicans.
Our right? districts where there are Republicans, because those are the numbers. Right. You know,
this is a time to say to Democrats and others who oppose this map, elections have consequences. Right. You know, you forget about that until you suddenly realize, oh, I didn't vote because I thought Bill White was boring.
Well, the Democrats.
Or I didn't vote because I was mad at Obama. You know what? You forfeit the right to complain when you don't vote. Elections have consequences. The Republicans won. The right. Republicans get to draw the maps. The Republicans have all five seats on the LRB. Nanny, nanny, boo, boo. That's basically what you say to everybody who complains.
We talked about this in November. You know, the Democrats got really clobbered at exactly the wrong time because the Republicans had the opportunity and are taking it to institutionalize the November wins.
Right.
Well, can you also just, we're running out of time, but could you also give us a quick update on the budget and what happens now?
The Senate's passing out a budget this week out of committee. They're going to send it to the full Senate after Easter. You know, if everything stays, if the trains all stay on the track, they'll vote out a budget that's about $16 billion. We haven't seen bottom line numbers yet, but it's about $16 billion bigger than the House's, which means it's about $5 billion lower than current spending. They're still trying to find ways to pay for it. They came up with, you know, $5 billion worth of stuff.
Well, that's not very much.
Non-tax stuff. It's not enough.
16.
It's change in the cushions of your couch.
Right. It's not enough stuff yet. So, you know, after May 1st, after the full Senate passes a budget, this will go to conference committee and we'll really start trying to close this, what looks like a $16 billion difference between the House budget and the Senate budget.
The House budget's going to be much more like the final budget than the Senate budget, isn't it?
Well, I think there's an interesting thing in the House. There's a, you know, there's this thing called printouts that they do on school finance, where whenever you do any kind of change to school finance, you do printouts, and it basically shows every member of the legislature what the school districts, how the school districts in their districts fare. There's 1,100 school districts.
This is not runs. This is the
it's also called the runs, but you know, I was trying to avoid that conversation. So they do
that. Yeah, a lot of people are saying this session
it's
is giving
birthday,
me the runs.
So they have the runs.
Right,
okay.
So
they didn't do the runs, and the House has $7.8 billion in cuts to school districts, but they have not seen individually what that means in their own district. And I think that when the House sees that.
I think last night, wasn't there a public education hearing on Wednesday night, Tuesday night, in which those runs were finally out and people are going, I'm cutting what?
I'm doing what? Mrs. Johnson from the English class?
What?
That lady from my church? I mean, you know, so there's a lot of story to be told.
Shouldn't we get those runs and publish those runs on the Texas Tribune
site? The TEA has to do the runs. You got to get the permanent runs. Now, so what's happening? One of the things that's happening is the House and the Senate are finalizing their school finance plans, and once those are finalized, then they can do runs and everybody can see what the damage is.
And, you know, a lot of the school, we heard stories already earlier in the year about school districts across state making preemptive cuts, you know, planning based on what they thought the state was going to do. Most of the school districts, many of the school districts went through with three different plans. Worst case scenario, middle, best case scenario. A lot of them took the middle. The House version of the budget is the worst case scenario. So you've heard about all these cuts. You know, Austin's laid off 400 teachers, Round Rock's 200, others around the state.
Plano's 250.
Plano's 250. Well, that's the medium case scenario. So if it looks more like the House budget, there's actually a second round of cuts that a lot of these districts are going to have to make.
Well, we should say that if you think you can do a better job than either House, you can go to the Texas Tribune and there's an app where you can basically build your own budget, which is pretty neat. And if you like what you build there, you can send it to us. And if you have questions or comments about this TribCast, you can also send those to us at podcasts@texastribune.org. In the meantime,
we should get to item number 5 very quickly.
On behalf of Evan Smith, who is celebrating his 45th birthday today.
Ow, my back.
Ross,
I thought
Ramsey.
It was your knee.
At this point, Ben, when you're 45, everything attached to you or protruding from you begins to break.
You're a pup. It gets worse.
Yeah. We need to move on. All right. On behalf of Evan, Ross, Ben, our producer, Todd, I'm Reeve Hamilton. Thanks for listening.
My favorite line was where they said that your information.
Your favorite line from the Susan Combs letter.
Line from the Susan Combs letter was
that Ross didn't let you finish.
She said that. Are you going to let me finish?
also, it's not a Susan Combs letter. We spent 10 minutes talking about that.